Okay.
Morning, Mama.
How is every How is
Morning.
everybody?
Morning, morning.
Winter is in full swing. I hope people are taking care of themselves and they are safe. We're in alert level 2, so we must really try to be careful and cautious. Today we are on
Recording in progress.
our last day in terms of the
Recording
department.
stopped. Recording in progress.
I don't know this thing. The department take us through on the issues that were raised by stakeholders, individuals, companies, and interested groups, civil society, who came to make oral presentations, but also in that they've looked into what is in the written submissions. So that's where we are now. I'm raising this so that honorable members do understand that this presentation, these responses, which some of them may be in a form of a presentation, are responses that are to assist us when we deliberate. So there will be that thin line between a response, which may be in a form because of the gravity of the sensitivity, the importance, the challenges of issues that have been raised. The department will then either take a form of responding in a form that will make us or empower us as members of the committee when we are to deliberate. So it's responses which are to assist us for deliberations. It's not like a report, a quarterly report that is to be tabled in front of us, or we have invited a particular entity or the department to come and make a presentation in front of us. I thought it's going to be very important that I do clarify that to members, having an understanding that members have been, the bill has been with us for a couple of months, presentations, written presentations, submissions have been with us for a couple of months, and oral submissions were made. And we're here just to remind members that when we started this process, as the chair, I did humbly request that in whatever is being said, we are to put it on paper so that when we deliberate, we are able to go back. So, and check on our notes, what has been said, what was not said, what we are proposing, because this has not been said. So that is the process in terms of an amendment dealing with. It does not mean that members won't ask questions of clarity if they want to be clarified, but they are to understand that those questions that we will be asking are questions that are going to assist us in moving forward. So that's where we are today. So what then we will then do, by so doing, I'm welcoming everybody. And I want to humbly request those persons that are not in the department or in parliament, introduce themselves, tell us which company or media house they are coming from. I have an experience which I did raise that in the last meeting. So we would like to know who is here. Yeah, and well, as we know that this is just like any, it takes a form. It is still guided by rules. If we're physical, we'll request people to tell us who they are, which institution they are coming from. Because after all, committees are, can the hand hold on a bit? We are still going to be dealing with our house keeping rules. Then after that, we will invite whoever wants to introduce themselves. Having said that, welcoming everybody. In PE, it's bitterly cold. I will then ask Ms. Ntabeni to take us through in terms of the roll call. And the DG will then take us through and we'll get all the guests. And after that, if the minister is around, we'll just a brief overview. And then we allow whoever from the department is going to take us through. Over to you, Ms. Ntabeni.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable members, as well as colleagues. So far, Chairperson, from the committee, we have the following members in attendance. We have the Honorable Chairperson Dundwa, Honorable Mdabe, Honorable Nontele, Honorable Bagraim, Honorable Kado, Honorable Yinana, Honorable Mkondo, Honorable Ngobo, as well as Honorable Denner. And from the committee support staff, we have myself, Poshia Ntabeni, the committee assistant, Sibongiseni Gogo, the content advisor, Tebuo Mokoena, the researcher, as well as Ms. Kolelwa Mabindisa, the executive secretary. Thank you, Chair. Oh, sorry, Chair, I didn't receive any apologies. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ntabeni. DG?
Good morning, Chairperson and the honorable members. Chairperson, the department's delegation is led by the minister and the deputy minister. We have colleagues that will take us through the presentation. We have Mr. Vuyo Mafata, the commissioner of the compensation fund, Mr. Mkalipi. We have Mr. Virgil Spifield. We also have Tando Ababa, who's the PLO. We have Advocate Mukhashwa, who's the legal officer from the Compensation Fund. We have Ministry Support Staff, the Chief of Staff, Mr. Kangala Mudumela, and we have Ms. Karabo. We have Mr. Zandi Mweli. We also have Matapelo from my office, Chair. We will be joined shortly by Mr. Musa Zondi. I know, Chair, you'd like to ask who's Musa Z. Mr. Zondi was the communication person from the department. We'll be joining shortly. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I will talk about this when we are at the end. Are there any guests? Are there any guests that are in our meeting?
Thank you.
Yes.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Suraya Williams. I'm from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. We will be assisting with drafting the amendments to the bill after the committee has deliberated on the bill. I'm joined by my colleague, Sara Govender, who's a senior state law advisor from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. She will be observing the meeting, and I will be also observing the meeting, Chair, following the deliberation. So when the amendments is being drafted to the bill, we're able to follow and understand how the amendments should be affected to the bill.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much. I've got Mr. Hudson. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yes, there are another visitor, Geoffrey Nzau, representing Acuria Society of South Africa, and yes, as observant.
Thank you. I can't hear you. We can't hear you, unfortunately. There's something wrong with your system. Mr. Tiwalt, or
good morning, Chair. My name is Tiwalt Tachler. I am the Chief Operations Officer of Coedlink, just an interested observer. Thank you.
Okay. So those are the only people that are here. Can you lower your hand? I don't know why PMG is not prepared to. We'll say good morning.
It's Myrtle, but boy, I'm from the South African Domestic Workers, and I'm based here in Cape Town.
Thank you. Thank you. Please, Esther, mute. Thank you very much. Who's GN? The hand is up. Who's this N Saul?
Chair, it's Leanne Zhao, CEO of Coedlink.
Okay. Tim?
Chair, good morning. I hope you can hear me. Good morning. Good morning, honourable members. I have the honour to be spokesperson of the Injured Workers Action Group. Good morning to you all.
Thank you very much. And I hope everybody who's here, who's a guest, will understand that, please, because I don't want the confusion that has been created, that people think that we are starting with deliberations when we are responding to what your company, the department, is clarifying and responding in some of the issues that you have raised, because we'll then be, as I've said initially, we are preparing for deliberations. So please, I hope you'll understand, and I'm not going to be called by people telling me that their sources told them that we are deliberating, we are busy deliberating with the bill. I would like to clarify that I'm raising that, members, because this process is a process that is very sensitive. People can create so many perceptions about the work of the committee. And as a chair, I don't have energy for that. I have energy of ensuring that as members of parliament in this portfolio committee, the department led by the ministry, we are doing what then we are supposed to do. I know these issues are very emotive, they're very sensitive, people are interested, but people must understand that parliament has got its own rules governing its processes, and there's nothing wrong with people coming here, but people must not go out and say things that are not correct. If they don't understand, they will have to phone the secretariat for the secretariat to assist them. Minister, just a brief overview.
Thank you, Chairperson. To yourself, the members of the committee, the Deputy Minister, the DG, and all the officials of the department and the compensation fund and the members of the media, of course, and ladies and gentlemen. On another note, just a little diversion today. The coronavirus daily statistics are showing that we're moving up at an alarming rate. There's even a headline that 9 congregants die as coronavirus or COVID-19 sweeps through the Fredendal Church. I think it's just to say, let's even be more serious about this. But coming back to the point, Chairperson, thank you for this opportunity, Chair. As usual, I will try to provide an overview while the DG, the Commissioner and the team provide a detailed presentation on the response or on the departmental response to submissions which were received by the Portfolio Committee on Employment and Labour on the Corridor Amendment B. The first point to make is that part of the core mandate of the department is to continuously strive to regulate and strengthen the conditions for decent work for South African workers. Part of this is to inspect and enforce laws and regulations relating to the health and safety in the workplace. It also includes providing support for workers who are injured or contract illness in the workplace, part of the social security network that government has developed over years, striving always to improve the provision of services. Let me address the response on Section 73, Subsection 4 of the Amendment Bill in relation to the role of third parties acting on behalf of service providers within the compensation system. The legal problems with the third party agents include the following. They fall outside of the ambit of the National Health Act and the Council for Medical Schemes. And therefore, there is no regulatory oversight. Secondly, they do not qualify as authorized institution or healthcare providers or personnel in terms of the National Health Act. And thirdly, they do not qualify as mutual associations as per the COIDA Act. Amongst others, the legal lacuna has implications for patient confidentiality. The fund also experiences a challenge with receiving from the third party the necessary information in order to complete processing of claims, leading to delays in payment, which the third party agent then blames the fund. There's currently 100,000 such delayed claims in the system. And this has consequences in that the third party has no interest in the fund exercising due diligence on claims. And indeed, it lobbies hard to loosen strict restrictions for the payment of claims. So to them, it's about payment of claims, the issue of true diligence seems to be not an interest. So it is a vicious cycle, Chair, as third parties are leading to delays in finalizing the claim. Then this is used as an argument to justify the existence of the third parties. So the solution to this conundrum is for the fund to improve efficiency. And we are not saying the fund does not have its own problems, but the officials will speak more on this. But I think we should all take responsibility so that the third-party agents cost to service providers, as they will not have to pay third-party fees. Let me refer briefly to the comments on the proposed amendments on insertions and deletions. The comments on Section 7.3, subsection 4 regarding the third parties have been addressed, but the highly technical proposals received from a range of stakeholders have received due consideration by the department and the fund, and in some cases, the department supports these proposals, but allow me to leave this to the officials to respond, who are going to respond in detail. It would serve no purpose other than repetition for me to go through the responses. But the officials are going to be dealing with that, the chairperson and members. And again, thank you to the Honorable Chair and the members for the opportunity. And I still want to assure you that we are fully supportive of the oversight and the accountability that this portfolio committee provides. There are a number of issues which have been raised, which are not for a discussion today. But as and when we give you a report, you could see that you are hard at work, we are cleaning the institution so that we are able to deal and execute the mandate properly. But that would be for another day. And then, Jefferson, thank you very much. We can hand over to the officials. But I must also indicate that today, the Cabinet Committee for Economic Sectors, Investment, Employment and Infrastructure Development, which we call ESET, is dealing with the issues of the monitoring and evaluation overview reports focusing on economic transformation and job creation, including the issue of the training. And at some stage, I will have to jump maybe at about 10 o'clock into that cabinet committee because my department is central to those discussions. Thank you, Deputy Minister. I mean, thank you, Chairperson. Of course, who are here with the Deputy Minister.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Minister. Can we then hand over now to the Department DG? I can see Honorable Mr. Mkhalipi is in. Now it's your turn. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, with our presentation is in four parts, but we would like to ask Mr. Mkhalipi to do the first part because he falls into that category of workers that must be that must receive the vaccine. So at some point he will have to leave and get the vaccine administered. So he will start with the areas where there were certain submissions, and then Mr. Mafata will then follow up with the issues that affect to a greater extent the provision that the minister was talking to relating to third parties. You will go into details because some of the comments that were made were related to the fact that even the system that has been developed is intended to exclude the third parties and is dysfunctional. So he will report, he will touch on a number of those aspects after the presentation done by Mr. Mkhalip. Thank you, Chair. We'll hand over to Mr. Mkhalip.
Thank you, Mr. Mkhalip. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Can we flag the presentation? Thank you, Vuyo. The first issue that Chair would want to deal with in our report is the socioeconomic impact assessment study, and then Vuyo will come in, deal with the issues around performance as the DG has indicated, and then we'll come back and deal with our response on the actual proposals that have been made. Now, this socioeconomic impact studies, I mean, there's been a big a comment by members of the public and about whether the socioeconomic impact study is enough, whether it should have been published, and we thought that we need to come and debunk these issues about the socioeconomic impact study. This bill that is in front of the members went through this process, and then the social impact study is internal government process. It's managed and monitored by the Department of Planning and Monitoring and Evaluation, DPME. It's not the responsibility of the department that are bringing policies and legislation to decide what is it that they need to provide in the socioeconomic impact assessment. Before the bill can be tabled in the DG cluster, in cabinet, and approval to be published for public comment or for tabling in parliament, there's got to be a socioeconomic impact assessment. And this assessment is done using the template that is provided by the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation, which is the same template with all government departments that we use to give the information. And if we give the information that is required in terms of the template, and the DPME then issue a certification for the bill in order for the bill to be provided either for public comment or for the bill to go to cabinet for parliament. As we've indicated, the certification is then included with the bill for tabling both in the DG cluster and the cabinet before any approval can be granted. There's no legal requirement in terms of that process of cabinet and the DME and the Department of Planning and Monitoring for the economic assessment to be published. But as we've indicated in the past, that this is published in our website and is available for members of the public if they want to see it in our website, or they can contact our department for copies for them to see it. But it is a government tool to make sure that cabinet has got a sense of what the impact of social impact of any policy that is being introduced. In relation to this bill, the social economic impact assessment was conducted before the bill was published for comment in September 2018. And again, it was done after public comment before the bill was sent for parliament, here in parliament. If it was done twice at this to make sure that we follow all the process that needed to be followed. Next slide, please. Now, consultation in this bill, the other issue that has been raised about by many organizations about the fact that they were not consulted and there was no consultation in the bill. Now, consultation took place internally within government. public comments after approval of the bill by the cabinet. Consultation with social partners at NEDLAC took place where business, organized labor and communities represented. And public consultation or public hearings was held by the department in all provinces, taking members of the public through the bill and the issues raised. And all those issues were taken into consideration in drafting this bill. Next slide, please. Now, as I've indicated, that government departments were consulted, departments before the bill was put in front of cabinet and parliament, Department of Communication and Postal Services were consulted, Department of Transitional Affairs, Department of Women, Department of Transport, Department of Environment Affairs, and the Department of Mineral and Mineral and Resources. Furthermore, as we've indicated, public consultation were held in all provinces. The bill was tabled in Parliament in NEDLAC for deliberation. The Director General Klasa was also consulted on the bill because it was presented. They can't go to cabinet before going to the cluster. And it was satisfied that the state law advisors, in keeping with government decision, that all bills that are provided for public comments or for Parliament should be satisfied by state law advisors. Next slide, please. And now, Commissioner will take over this process and deal with the issues of performance of the fund, because there's been a lot of question about how best the fund perform and deal with issues and claims. And the Commissioner will try and debunk and give information. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mukalipi. Mr. Mafata.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, there were also comments raised around the performance of the fund when the emphasis for the need for third parties in the environment.
Sorry, Commissioner. I'm not quite sure whether it's your speaker, it's a bit, or it's me. I don't know whether you are a bit far from it, or is it, or your speaker is a bit, low. I don't know how to term that. If it's appropriate for you to come closer to it a bit.
Thank you, Chair. I will also raise my voice. So thank you very much, Chair. So there was a lot of comments raised also around the performance of the fund and the dysfunctionality of the fund and the fact that we're not able to discharge our mandate fully, hence the need for some of the role players in the fund, in the space. So what we're reflecting also in the next slides is just to show how the fund has been working over the last few years. Without spending much time on the statistics, just show that we have been consistent in how we've registered claims over the last few years, in excess of 100,000 claims that have been registered relating to those that are injured in the workplace. So this just shows the 6-year history of how the fund has been able to register the claims. And we can see in the last financial year, 2020-21, was about 160,000 claims that got registered in the fund. And this just shows then the rent values of the claims that we've paid. And you can see the breakdown between medical benefits, compensation benefits, as well as the pensions that we pay out to those that are permanently disabled. So it just shows then the history over the 6-year period. Also contrasting with some of the comments that were raised around the fact that the fund does not pay and does not discharge in mandate. So I will not spend much time here, Chair. So, Chair, there's also the issues around the CompEasy system. So the CompEasy system is a system that was implemented by the Compensation Fund in October 2019 as a new system that was meant to be able to improve service delivery as well as address some of the weaknesses that had been found in our previous systems. So we went live in October 2019 and we released the functionalities in the systems gradually over the period of about 4 or 5 months. And by end of February, for all intents and purposes, all role players could then transact on the system and be able to submit claim, be it as an employer online or whether it's something that is submitted manually to the fund for the fund to register, as well as medical invoices that could be submitted through the various means that the fund allows for invoices to be submitted. So, however, the requirements, as we've indicated, are different to what people are used to in the past. We have seen a lot of change management issues with those that refuse to adapt to the changed ways of doing business with the compensation fund, and the way that the requirements that the fund now requires to be able to make sure that we authenticate those that submit claims, in as much as we authenticate the validity of the claims that are submitted to the compensation fund. So obviously the system won't work for any person who is not willing to abide by the rules that have been set for the use of the system. Starting with the registration of people as users on the system, we know that the previously in the past registration on the Department of Employment and Labor's website as a online user was sufficient for you to be able to utilize any of the systems of the department. However, with the Comp Easy system, we've added an additional layer of validation, which requires people to be able to register also separately using those credentials that have been provided by the department to register as a user on the Comp Easy system. And the reason is that then there's additional documentation that is required to prove the validity of the person who's registering, as well as to prove the fact that you have been delegated by the company in which you are purporting to be representing to submit any claims to the compensation fund. This is one of the ways to want to improve the authenticity of claims that are submitted to the fund. So in the previous system, only the step one and somehow just a simple process just to get access to the system to be able to then transact. So if a person is not willing to abide by these, and obviously to him or to her, the system will not work. So this slide just shows them the details. It's just the details of what is required and expected of a person who then registers. When you're an employer, these are all the documents that need to be submitted. If these documents are not submitted, you will not be able to get access to the system. And we have seen a lot of chance taking as well, where the thinking is that the fund will not peruse these documents before they give access. And we find ourselves having to decline a lot of applications because people are not attaching the correct documents. And the complete documents as well. And when you're a medical service provider as well, the same requirements and some additional requirements that are highlighted on the slide. And the intermediaries, because we do know that those that deal with the fund, be it its employers or its medical service providers, they tend to outsource some of the work related to managing occupational injuries and diseases in the workplace. And if somebody has then been appointed as such, they then need to prove that they've been appointed as such. And these are the relevant documentation that they need to submit to the fund. And if they don't submit these, then they will not be able to transact on the system. And once again, the system won't work for them. And so this is just the statistics that shows that in the past, because of the relaxed requirements that we've had around people that use the system, we had a lot of users. If you look at the old system, about 60,000 users, even when we did contact. So the requirements on the new system was that everybody would have to register afresh as a user on the system because they needed to submit all this relevant documentation. And when you look at the 60-odd thousand people that we had in the old system, this is those that have been able to prove that they represent either the employer, the medical service provider, the third parties. We only have just over 8,000 users that have been able to register and submit the documentation that proves that they are authenticated and they have been given the proper authority by the people that they represent to submit claims on their behalf. So when it comes to also registering of claims in the system, so the claims can be registered externally using the tab, the application tab that we've made available on Comp Easy, that an employer or a third party that represent an employer can go to. If they have the authority to register on behalf of such an employer, they can then be able to register on the system and register a claim on the system, or they can submit the forms manually to us, which are then registered by claim handlers at the compensation fund. And then we can be able to adjudicate the claim and authorize for payment. So only an authorized employer user or an authorized person by an employer can be able to register a claim. And we have provided requirements. I'll touch on some of these requirements in later slides around what is a full and valid claim that needs to be submitted. But this then just provides an indication of what they need to submit when registering claims. So this just then shows over the last since we went live with the system, just shows the breakdown of some of the benefits that we've been able to pay in a computer system, just over 200 million in just the until end of the financial year this year. Then just shows the breakdown of claims that are in the system at a specific period. We can see that we have over 1.4, 1.5 million claims that are in the CompEasy system, including those that we've migrated from old systems. I'll refer to some of the statistics in some of my later present slides. So similarly, medical claims, because those that are injured in the workplace, they then also go to medical providers for medical treatment. So we have also made provision in the CompEasy system for claims to be captured internally. If a service provider submits a manual invoice to the compensation fund, we're able to capture it and process it. They can also be submitted through a switching process or an FTP process, where they then use an intermediary who then compiles, who has to compile with all the requirements. And these requirements, we gazetted them and made sure that those that are going to be submitting electronic claims on behalf of medical practitioners, they know what the requirements are. And also these, we've also made an application tab or an app on the CompEasy system that allows a medical practitioner or those that work for medical practitioners to be able to capture the invoice themselves and submit them to the fund. And it has we have proven that people that use Switch and also those that submit using the manual, the app that we've made available, we get those invoices quicker, and we're able to then authorize and pay those invoices much quicker. And obviously, one of the also pain points that may cause pains for many people is the fact that we've built in additional clinical rules and codes, which would also then assist us with identifying invalid or unaccepted claims in some of the areas, over-servicing and non-compliant claims that we need not pay. So if a claim doesn't meet all full requirements of in terms of the COID legislation, we don't accept such an invoice. And if it's in the system, it has been accepted, but it's still missing some additional information, we also then don't pay such invoices. And this slide just shows the breakdown of what we've paid since we went live with the system, and also what just showing in the last financial year what was paid. You can see that we've processed over 3 billion rands in invoices since the CompEasy system went live, and we have paid more than 2.9 billion of these invoices. So, Chair, there was a lot of questions that was asked also around, with the amendment or the inclusion of Section 73, subsection 4, what is it that we're trying to address? So I'll take my time also in taking the committee through some of the legal as well as the operational challenges that the use of third parties, particularly with regards to ceding of claims to external providers from healthcare providers, some of the challenges that it creates, and with regards to legislation as well as the operations of the fund. So, Chair, so third parties have, as they presented, that they represent both employers in some cases as well as medical service providers. And they claim that they're then assisting the fund to carry out its mandate. So to enable the committee to be able to make them the informed decisions, we basically will take you through some of the legal framework under which some of the role players in the claims process have to abide by, and how this benefits the fund, and what are the issues that this causes. So we derive our mandate from the COID Act, and everything else that we do in terms of the COID legislation. The COID legislation, because we provide medical aid, we provide compensation, and so on, we then also have to comply with many other laws that we have to make sure that these are complied with. Chief among those, Chair, is the National Health Act, because it governs and guides the manner in which the personal details of those that are treated in private and public health facilities or by healthcare practitioners, everybody needs to abide by. So I'll just touch briefly on some of these sections that relate to it. And we know that effective from the 1st of July, the POPI Act also comes into effect, which also then places the legal onus on the fund to ensure that the confidentiality of our clients' information is also upheld. So in this slide, Chair, this just seeks to just show the role, the way that the claim process happens. So if a worker in the workplace gets injured. In terms of the law, the person is required to report an injury to an employer within 7 days. And once the employer receives such a notification, the employer doesn't have to say, I believe you or I don't believe you. So the decision of whether this is an occupational injury or disease is a determination that will be made by the fund after receiving the accident reports as well as the report from the treating doctor. So they then have to submit, so while the person has gone to the employer, they then need to be sent to a healthcare facility. But at the same time, they also then need to inform or the fund and register a claim with the fund. And once the claim has been registered, we then await for some of the claim forms, the information that needs to be completed by the treating practitioner. And the treating practitioner would then have to submit this information either back to the employer for the employer to submit to the fund, or in some cases when they already know what the claim number is, they can submit this information to the fund. And these are medical reports, in this case, which is the first medical report. And we then adjudicate a claim based on the information that we receive from the employer and the treating practitioner. If we've accepted liability for such a claim, then the medical practitioner can then be able to submit invoices to the fund for the fund to be able to then pay the invoice. And if, in terms of the law, for the first 2 months of the injury, if the worker has been temporarily disabled and is going through treatment, the employer pays the salary of the worker. And then we then, once we have accepted liability, we then get the necessary documentation from the employer, and we're able to then to pay the TTD, or the temporary total disablement payout, to the employer. If now the fund is paying it to the claimant, we then be able to pay it to the claimant, and we communicate even the outcomes of adjudicating the claim or the medical claim to the healthcare practitioner. So this is meant to be a process if all the role players play their part. Employer registering a claim and taking responsibility for making sure that this claim reaches the fund. And once it reaches the fund adjudicates the claim with all the information that has been submitted and the reports that we get from the practitioner. Then we can be able to communicate back to the employer and to the medical practitioner in terms of what the claim number is, and accept an invoice that is submitted by the medical practitioner to be able to pay. At the end of this whole process, once all processes have been completed, there's progress medical reports that the medical practitioner needs to submit to the fund to continue, for us to continue then to be able to pay the TTD to the worker, as well as the medical invoices that needs to be paid back to the healthcare practitioner or healthcare provider if the worker is still undergoing treatment. At the end of all this process, and the law gives about 24 months, some injuries may be more complex while this person is going through treatment. In some of the cases, the person may go through treatment quicker. And once the final medical report has been submitted to the fund by the medical practitioner, either directly to the fund or through the employer, we then are able to make a final assessment on the claim and then pay the final payout to the worker. So in an event that the worker is deemed to be permanently disabled based on the final medical report, this person will then be, depending on the degree of disablement, person may either qualify for a lump sum payment from the fund or from a lump sum payment plus pensions that they would then enjoy from the fund from that point going forward. So this is an ideal process that then needs to be followed when we deal with a claim in the later slides, and then I'll just show how this process sometimes gets broken, and it gets broken due to most cases non-compliance by employers, and sometimes even the involvement of some of the third parties who are not anywhere specified in the COID legislation in the processing of the claims. So when I look at the role players, we have healthcare practitioners who are regulated. So now healthcare practitioners are regulated in terms of the Health Professions Council, Health Professions Act through the HPCSA. They have to comply with certain requirements, ethical conduct as well that is expected of them, because they deal with sensitive patient information. We also have hospitals that are registered with that get their licenses from the Department of Health, and also all healthcare practitioners and providers who are going to claim from medical aids or healthcare funders are required also to be registered in the practice code numbering system. So this is a system that the Bureau of Healthcare Funders administers on behalf of the Council for Medical Schemes. So you cannot submit a claim anywhere if you have not been issued with a practice code number. So now, in the registering with this, there's a number of validations and checks that a healthcare provider has to abide by to get this particular number, right? So these are some of the checks and balances that are available for the healthcare fraternity, making sure that in dealing with the patients, safeguards and so on. And then you also have employers who would have their own regulatory bodies in some of them that they have to comply with, but most of them all have to then register with the DTI through CIPC if they are incorporated institutions. And we have the Compensation Fund, which is an entity of the Department of Employment and Labor, and it's then has to abide by the regulations and laws that have been set with regard to adjudication of claims. If you look at it, so these are the three role players that play a part in the registration, adjudication, and payment of claims of workers and dealing with the sensitive information of those that are injured in the workplace. We have different types of third parties that then operate in the fund to be able to help some of these role players that have been highlighted above. So we have, I spoke earlier on about the FTP process that employers uses to, or medical practitioners use to submit batched medical invoices because of the volumes of some of these invoices that are submitted to the fund. So these, the first group or type of third parties that we deal with in the COVID environment is the switching houses. So those that are appointed to use their technology to help medical providers to submit claims to healthcare funders such as the compensation fund or other medical aids based on the rules that that healthcare funder would have set for submission of such invoices. So this, the healthcare funder then, or the compensation fund in this case, would then receive the invoices, process the invoices, and pay the healthcare provider, because the switching house is just a conduit through which the healthcare provider submits the claims to the fund. We then also have some practice managers where, for example, some medical service providers would appoint a company to manage the administration of their practice. So some of these practice managers would then submit claims as part of their administration to either a switching house for the switching house to submit, or a medical bureau to submit to the fund, or in some of the cases, if the practices are small and they have embraced some of the technology that we've brought to them to be able to submit claims directly, they would capture some of these claims on CompEasy and then submit them to the fund. And once we've processed and paid these claims, we pay the money back directly to the medical service provider that treated the client. We then also have some of the third parties that may also be appointed by a medical service provider to manage the submission of their claims to the fund, and based on the rules of the fund or the healthcare funder, and then we pay the medical provider also equally back the money that has been claimed. Then we have this fourth type of third party, which is the pre-funders. I think they refer to themselves as pre-funders when they were making the submissions earlier on. So these are, they would then pre-fund invoices or cure these medical claims from a doctor or a healthcare practitioner or a healthcare facility. And then they would submit this as their own to the compensation fund based on the rules that the fund has. So the practice is then that because they own this invoice now, this money then gets paid back to them. It's the same parties. So part of the challenges that we'd have, that we as a practice that has always happened in the past, is that the same vendors would then also, in most instances, register the related claim with the fund. So you have an invoice where the medical practitioner has helped a client, but without a claim, this invoice cannot be paid. Because the system would allow any person who has access to the system to register a claim on behalf of an employer, you would find some of these vendors then registering these claims on behalf of the employer. But the knowledge of the employer, whether the claim was complete or not, as long as you had a claim number, you could then submit this claim to the compensation fund. which is the practice that we've seen with most of this. So whether we've accepted liability for a claim or not, a claim comes in. So when you look at this practice, it's equal to writing your own check, because you're sitting with an invoice which you have procured from a medical provider, but for your invoice to be paid, you need a corresponding claim. So you then go in and register that particular claim. So with the amendment of Section 73, with the inclusion of Subsection 4, this was meant to correct this anomaly with this particular type of third parties. And I'll expand on this point in the subsequent slides. So I mentioned earlier on the requirements of the medical service providers in terms of registering on the practice code numbering system through the BHF, then being obviously then regulated through the National Health Act, the Health Professions Act, and so on. So nowhere is there a third party, or this third party that now owns a medical invoice is regulated. So there is no specific set or code of conduct or code of ethics that they are forced to abide by in ensuring patient confidentiality and making sure that the sensitive information of the claimant is not abused and is not used for any other purpose other than for the benefit of the injured worker. So that's one of the big legal challenge that you have with these third parties. And as I indicated, there is nowhere, even in the Council for Medical Schemes, where there is some kind of an oversight that is played over these third parties. When we zoom in on the National Health Act, because it relates, any person who gets treated at the healthcare facility is defined, healthcare practice defined in the nation. Information and the manner and the ways in which anybody else can access. And if you look at the access that it provides for in Section 15, that a health worker or any healthcare provider that has access to the health records of a user may disclose such personal information to any other person, healthcare provider, or healthcare establishment as is necessary for any legitimate purpose within the ordinary course and scope of his or her duties, where such access is in the interest of the user. So I don't know what interest of the, if you look at some of the challenges I'll highlight earlier on, I'm not sure in what the interest of the patient or the injured workers has been. We've seen also in the submissions that were made in defense of the practice and the use of third parties, how no mention was made of the injured worker. Instead, the mention was made mainly only of the healthcare provider that needs to be paid. So we, as a fund, we battle to see how is this in the interest of a user or the patient or the injured worker that such transfer of these records are made to third parties. Because we speak a lot about the personal information of the injured workers and how this personal information of injured workers is then given to third parties who may not have any oversight bodies that looks at the ethical conduct of these bodies. So a medical invoice that the compensation fund requires to be submitted by a medical provider, healthcare provider, or healthcare institution, complies with the regulated types of accounts that a healthcare provider needs to submit to a healthcare fund, right, as issued in the Medical Schemes Act. So all the personal details of the injured worker has to be in the invoice, practice code number of the treating practitioner, the diagnosis of the person that is being treated by the doctor has to be included in the invoice that is submitted to the fund for payment, as is the requirements in the Medical Schemes Act. So for all intents and purposes, the invoices of the fund then complies with the requirements that are required to be submitted in terms of the Medical Schemes Act. Now, here is just a typical example of an invoice that is submitted to the compensation fund. So this is a snapshot of an invoice as it appears on CompEasy. So all the items that are that we have blocked out in red, these are all the personal details of the person that is injured. So if you go back to the practice of ceding the claim to somebody else, so this is all the information that then that gets given to these third parties. If you look at the item that is circled in here, so this is the, if you look at this particular item, so this is the diagnosis. So this particular person, this is the diagnosis that led to the injury or the injury that this person has suffered. So this is an ICD-10 code. So anybody who has this information, if they want to know what's wrong with me, they can just go and check either on the ICD-10 codes, which are published on the World Health Organization website, and I'm sure anybody also can Google this. And then they can see that a diagnosis S82.00V49.82 is this kind of disease that this person suffers. So now this is the personal information of a patient that moves from a healthcare practitioner to somebody else who did not treat the practitioner, who's not the practitioner himself or herself. And so that's the main issue also with regard to how this also breaches the confidentiality. We haven't even touched on the requirements in terms of POPI to show that where such information of the user has been shared, it is done with the consent of this particular patient that is being treated. So when you look at and summarize a lot of the issues, so when this slide, we've tried to bring in the third parties and how then this whole process breaks the chain that ought to be followed in terms of the COID legislation. So when you look at some of the operational challenges that we've seen is that when a person gets injured in the workplace, the person, as is required, would report the injury to the employer. And then the employer would then send the person to a healthcare practitioner or healthcare facility for treatment with the necessary forms that have been completed by the employer and needs to be completed with by the practitioner. So in this case of where the claims are being ceded, for example, the employer, you can see, doesn't even report the claim to us. What would happen is that once a healthcare practitioner has treated the client, as part of, if it's the healthcare practitioner that has ceded that cedes his right to a claim to somebody else, they would then, together with those invoices, submit these to a third party. The third party then communicates or registers the claim with the compensation fund. And oftentimes they would then register the claim, and once they've registered the claim, they have a claim number, they would then submit the invoice that they've procured from this particular provider to the fund for the fund to pay it. And there's also then that communication between either the third parties or between even the healthcare provider with the fund in terms of submitting medical reports for the purposes of submitting a client. And oftentimes, this process ends up in this triangle, right? The poor worker may have been treated, may have received the medical treatment that he or she requires, but that's the end of the process for him or her, because in most cases, you end up even having no way to even contact the particular person to be able to then finalize the claim, because what would have been submitted here would have been information that is sufficient to be able to register a claim and adjudicate it. But adjudication of a claim is just the first step of finalizing the injured worker's claim. There's a number of things that has to go in. There's continuous treatment where we need to get to progress medical reports, final medical reports. There's resumption reports that we need to get from the employer if this person is not going back to work or if this person is going to work. So if these parties are no longer involved in the claim, you find that the interests that are being served is only of these parties around here and not necessarily of the claimant. And we recognize the important role that healthcare providers play in the treatment of workers. So, and the system works and the process works if all the role players, employers, the healthcare providers and the fund play their part in making sure. Because after all, this instrument, the COIDA legislation, has been put in place to make sure that it protects workers and provides social security relief in an event that the worker is unable to earn an income if there's been an occupational injury or disease. But this process defeats that whole purpose because it then ends up saving other interests except that of the injured worker. We'll see when Mr. Mkalipi comments on some of the inputs that we're given around penalties, why it has become important for us to look at penalties around those that don't report claims, because in some of the cases, it's the worker that suffers when everybody else doesn't play their role in making sure that the claim is submitted and is submitted correctly. So when an employer or anybody who submits a claim, we require a fully completed form. So we have referenced these forms as the WCL2 or WCL1, which is what mostly the industry refers to them by. And a claim has to be fully completed for it to come to the fund for us to be able to help a client. And oftentimes we don't get these fully completed claims. And that was the challenge that we had had also in the past. And that's one of the reasons why you find a lot of workers who may have been injured some many years ago. And you'd find that we've paid everybody else around the claim, the healthcare providers or the third parties concerned, but the worker's claim has not been finalized but whoever submitted this claim, be it whether it's an employer or it's the third party on behalf of an employer or on behalf of a medical provider who would have sold his right to the claim to the third party, what is done is enough to be able to satisfy the interests of that particular party, but not enough information is provided to be able to make sure that the injured worker himself or herself also then gets his claim gets attended to. As I indicated, acceptance of liability is just the first part of it, and that's what enables a medical practitioner to be able to claim from the fund, but it's not the final process that the fund needs to go through to be able to make sure that we don't only accept liability on this claim, but we actually then pay whatever is due to the worker, what is due to the healthcare provider, and what is due to the employer in cases where we have to refund the employer. So we have large numbers. The minister referred to earlier on the number of claims that we have, that some of, most of which are claims where we have paid medical. Third parties, you don't get any assistance because the interest that may have been served by registering this claim was for the payment of a medical claim, not necessarily of finalizing a claim on behalf of a worker. And we then have to look for the employer for the injured worker. In some cases, we don't succeed. And the only time we're able to get the injured worker is if they have complained and submitted inquiries that they were injured so many years ago and their claims were never finalized. If they give us a claim number, you find that then there was some information that was missing in the claim, and only then are you able to start helping a worker and be able to make sure that you finalize the claim. So the minister, I think, referred to the slide in his opening remarks when he spoke about some of those claims that we may have that may fall in such categories. So this is just an example of a fully completed claims notification or a report of an accident by an employer. And for us to be able to start registering a claim, we need this form fully completed. In most cases, what you've seen, for example, even when you get it completed only with the information that enables you to be able to register this claim and possibly also accept liability for it if it's an occupational injury or an occupational disease. But it doesn't allow you, as I said, to be able to even do many other things in the interest of the worker to be able to pay back the worker or to pay the employer if there's been TTDs that were paid by the employer. And I think in the form itself, there's clear guidelines on who must complete what, but these are some of the things that also then that get neglected either by both the employer or those that submitting the claim on behalf of the employer. So as I indicated, a break in the chain that we had outlined above is one of the things that also leads to delays, and oftentimes, even in the previous submissions, a lot was said about how the fund delays in processing claims and paying claims and how dysfunctional the fund is. And some part of the inefficiencies cannot be solely blamed on the officials of the fund, but some of it also has a lot of external influences when you look at the some of the challenges that I have highlighted above. So that's just the, in some of the cases also I've touched on this, we have claims where we would have accepted liability because they've been submitted through this process, either the third party or the employer, but you're even unable to finalize it for the benefit of the worker because of some of the outstanding information that you're looking for that you may not have, and it may not be in the interest of a third party to be able to give you this information if they have it, because their interest was in the payment of a medical invoice, not necessarily in the payment of the injured worker's claim. So we've just also tried to just not spend much details on this. I indicated that there's about 160,000 claims that we registered in the 2020-2021 financial year. Liability was accepted for about 89,000 of these claims. So if we look at these claims, we try to look at all these claims, how many of them were able to be finalized and we could pay them versus what was paid to healthcare providers. So you see, of the 89,000 claims, only about 43,000 claims resulted in payment because you either had full information to be able to finalize it and you could pay this to the amount of about 267 million. But in the same corresponding period, what we've paid to healthcare providers is about 2.8 billion rands in some of these claims. So, and some of the claims that we would not have paid may join others that either are waiting for closure if the person has gone back to work and there's no payment that needs to be made, or if there was a permanent award or permanent disablement award that needs to be made, you need further information to be able to then process and close this claim. So, and you may not have it at the time that we closed the financial year. So it just shows the disproportion in terms of how much emphasis gets placed on paying healthcare providers and little on the, that's on the part of the third parties, and little on the finalization of claims. So Chair, I think I'll hand over then to Mr. Mkhapi to then take us through the specific inputs that were made in the bill itself on some of the various sections.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Mkhalipi?
Our presentation so far has dealt with two areas. The area before the bill, the socio-economic impact assessment and the operations of the bill, the consultation. Now, what are we saying in all in terms of the response? As the Commissioner has indicated, the majority of comment deals with section clause 43, section 73, 4 of the Act. And the Commissioner has spent a lot of time explaining the rationale, what are the issues around this issue. But nevertheless, we are going to respond on this in a way that we think will meet the requirement of most of our clients. Next slide, please. Now, the first area that we want to report on, Mr. Edwin Cholan from Solidarity proposed that the law in section one we should replace "and" with "or" where it says it defines accidents instead of "it should be". And we think that's not correct because we believe that there must be a link between the job and the injury, and the word "and" make that link. Now, when you take the word "and" out of that and you put "or", then you break that link between the injury and the employment. And we think that the two tests in the definition are important. That's why at the end there, that you've got, it's got to arise out and in the course of employment. It can't be an injury that had arise out, not in the course of employment. And that's our response on that proposal. Next slide, please. Now, there's been a lot of amendments made by the Mineral Council of South Africa. And the first one is the definition of accident and diseases. And they prefer that we should, instead of saying diseases, be clear that it's occupational diseases. And we are happy to accept this amendment that has been proposed by the Mineral Council, and we think that if you agree with us on this, the bill could be amended to factor that. And the next area that they are raising, they are raising the issue that on the definition of an employer organization, and they are linking the definition of an employer organization in clause 1K with section 43. Now 1K specifically talk to employer organization like BOSA, like Black Business Council and other employer organizations that operate in the space. And sections 83 talk to employers who employ employees. Therefore, an employer organization and an employer are two different things, although they interchange in the sense that an employer organization can be also an employer. But we do not think that it's necessary to make the change that they want us to make in this. We think section 1K is clear. It talks to employer organization. Next slide, please. Now, they also go on in South Africa, you've got presently workers working in the mines who are covered by an ODIMWA, and workers working outside the mining sector in all other sectors who are covered by COIDA. And there's been a lot of discussion between government departments, between Department of Employment and Labor, Mineral and Health, not only on ODIMWA, on the coverage in terms of social protection of workers. Now, although on principle we do not have an objection on the sentiment that are raised by Mineral Council of amalgamated different coverage, but we think that a lot of work still need to be done on this, because if it's done as it is now, you're going to have a situation where workers who are covered in ODIMWA get different coverage and benefit from workers covered by all COIDA, and when they are all under COIDA. Therefore, before we do this amalgamation, we've got to make sure that there's been a buy-in and we make the necessary changes. Therefore, we don't think at this stage it would be advisable to make the change that the Mineral Council is proposing on the area of coverage or DEMA. Although on principle, we think it's a good proposal. It's just that we don't think that there has been enough discussion that has taken place between the players in this area. And we think that we should start that discussion with the Mineral Council, with Labor, with the Department of Health, Department of Mineral and Energy, and our department to make sure that we consolidate coverage of workers under one umbrella, and because that's what they are proposing. But our problem then, as we say, is that there are other issues that we need to consider here, and also the issue of having to have two regimes and benefits covering the same workers in one legislation. It might open us on unnecessary constitutional challenges in terms of different benefits that are provided by the different organizations. Next slide, please. Now, they go on, in terms of the issues that they are raising of COIDA and the proposing amendment to Section 16.1 to enhance the issue of rehabilitation, life enhancement and assistance. And they proposing that the word life enhancement assistant by, and the word disease be substituted by the word occupational disease, that would agree on that. Our view on the definition of life enhancement assistant is as follows, that the provision of psychological support subsequent to the occupational injuries of diseases, which forms part of the clinical and vocational and social rehabilitation service, all in clause 12, section 22.5, which talk about severance of the business of employer. If you are, and they want this to be substituted by the words arranged by the employer, this is about transport. Now they say that if you get injured, if your transport is arranged by the employer, then the funds should be liable. They want the word severance of the business of the employer substituted with bed arranged by the employer. Our problem, we've got a problem with that. We think that severance of the business of the employer is more inclined towards occupational health and the injury at work. Because if you say arrange, the issue is that what happens when I get sick at work, let us say I collapse for whatever reason at work, I work for Parliament, and my employer arranged the transport for me to go home, and then I get an accident on the road going home on the transport that is arranged by the employer. And we think that this will just open the fund on unintended and unnecessary challenges. The word federance of the business of the employer, and because it's clear in this example that I'm making that when the employer arranges transport that takes me to hospital or takes me home, that I'm not federing the business of the employer. And it's clear then that the fund cannot be liable for that and of that accident. And that's the difference between us and the Minerals Council. And we don't think that we should accept the proposal that they are making. Next slide, please. Now, they also go on and make the suggestion that all decisions a full description is needed, as it should be clear if traveling from place of work or to home, you are covered. Now, our view is that this issue is clear. If your employer, remember, there are workers who get car allowance. Now, if the company, the department gives me a car allowance and I buy a car and I got injured going to work on this car allowance, am I covered by COIDA? And we say, no, you're covered. But if I work for the construction industry and the employer provides transport that goes and pick us out, or in the farmers go out, pick up workers at a point in the township for them to be going to work. Those workers, when they get into that transport that is controlled by the employer, they are covered by the fund. But workers who travel because they are traveling their own car with a car allowance provided by the employer are not covered when they get injured. And that's the essence of the definition and the differences between on this. Now, with the proposal that they are making that everybody who travels from home to work should be covered. And then we're making an example of a person who's using a car that is bought through a car allowance. Why should the fund cover me for driving my car that I bought through a car allowance? It's a transport and driving allowance that I've received from the employer. And therefore, we do not agree with the proposal proposed by Mineral Council on clause 12. We think that the clause as it is clear enough who is covered if you get injured traveling. If the transport is controlled by the employer, is provided by the employer, in the examples that I've used, in the farms, workers are transported by the employer. The employer comes and picks them up. In the construction sector, the same applies. If those workers get injured in that truck or in that car that they are provided, controlled by the employer, then the corridor covers them. Next slide, please. The Mineral Council go further and propose that we need to make it clear and protect continuation of the mutual societies that are present now with the changes that we are making now, so that you don't have a gap. And then we agree with this, that we should include in the business transitional arrangement that ensures that those mutual associations that exist presently that transact with the fund should not see themselves out of business as a result of the changes that we are making in the bill now. Therefore, we think that the bill has got to have a transitional arrangement covering those mutual associations that exist presently. Next slide, please. Now, the next issue that they are raising, they disagree with the penalty regime that we are introducing in the bill, and they want to limit it to the earnings of the employees involved in the accident instead of the 10% of the annual earnings as proposed. And look, there was a long debate on this issue at NEDLAC, members, and our view is that if an employer follows the law, report cases. Now, Vuyo has talked a lot about number of cases that are not reported, workers get injured. Now, if an employer report cases, does what the law requires, that employer has got no reason to fear the fines. If the employer just comply with the law, therefore, don't think that to have a penalty of 10% of the employees that are injured will make any difference and will make any significant fine. Fine must, we agree that fine must not be high in order to cripple the company, but fine must be effective enough to make sure that employers do the right thing. And we think that the 10% that is agreed, that is in the bill, of the total annual earnings declared by the employer is a reasonable compromise that meets the protection for the employer not to get out of business as a result of the penalties, but also make the penalties meaningful enough for employer to do the right thing. Next slide, please. Now, they again making a proposal that the commissioner must have a discretion in terms of Section 28, in terms of the prescription, and in terms of the penalties themselves, whether the penalty should be. We agree with the penalty with the social partners at NEDLAC that the 10% that was issued, we do not think that this is giving too much power to the commissioner, or as it is worded, we do not think that it is high. And as I've said, that if employers do the right thing, there's nothing to worry about this. And this was agreed at NEDLAC with the other social partners that were party to these negotiations. Next slide, please. Now, the next issue that they proposing, they proposing the issues around Section 56 and the amendment that to increase the compensation due to negligence of employers. And we think that the existing provision must remain unamended, as no engineer has been or will be appointed under regulation made under the Mineral Petroleum Resources Act. And they are proposing an extra amendment. And we think this amendment that they are proposing was not commented, or it was not part of the public comment in the bill. And we think it will be unfair to introduce at this late stage that kind of amendment. And they go on and make proposal that clause 47, section 78 of the bill must be amended to allow that an election, that if an employer make an election, if an employer makes an election in terms of this of payment, direct payment to the fund, be made to the fund, that then the commissioner must be able to agree on this. And we don't think that we agree with this, the current provision in the Act that allow reimbursement of party that paid medical aid is enough instead of and then medical aids also are allowed to claim directly from the fund. We don't think this is an issue at all, and it's not necessary. Next slide, please. And they also raise the issue on section 93D, clause of 59, where they say people who are being questioned must have a right against self-incrimination. That's a constitutional provision. There's really no reason for that. It is a legal principle that you've got a right to refuse question that will self-incriminate anybody. Therefore, we don't think that's necessary, but it's not here nor there. I mean, if members believe that it needs to be needed, but the constitution of the country protect you against incriminating yourself in answering on any question, whether it's asked by an inspector, whether it's asked by the police or anybody, you protect it in terms of the constitution of the country. Next, like this. The Commission for Gender Equality, their response would be linked to the questions that were asked, because they're asking the same question with QAS QASA, and we'll deal with that at that stage. The South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, they are proposing that to amend Section 53 so that no limitation should be imposed on the commissioner's right to correct an assessment. We believe that to place a reliance on an estimate and disagree with the proposal for actual reliance on actual. We think that the present situation that deals with this issue that they are raising, and there's no need for us to be making the changes that they ask us to change. And they go further in clause 52. They make a proposal that the fund should have a framework that deal with rebate. We agree with the framework, but we do not think that it should be in the law. It's something that can be regulated outside the law, because when you're dealing with a framework, you must be able to change it quickly instead of having to change the law when changes need to take place. Next slide, please. Now, QASA is raising the issue that they support the amendment but propose that the commissioner should be given discretion to allow for submission of claims even after 3 years. That we think can be factored in there. If good cause is shown why a claim was not made after 3 years, if good cause is shown that an employer, for whatever reason, knew about this but did not do anything, and we agreed that workers should not be disadvantaged on the basis that the employer has not done the right thing, if the commissioner is given that discretion, showing good cause, why a claim that is more than 3 years should be allowed, then the commissioner should be given the discretion in that. And on the issue of section 73, they raise the issue that permanent disabilities, workers and payment of medical costs must remain open, which just don't think that is necessary to keep this open, and we believe that the closing and reopening of claim is a safety measure for the control mechanism to ensure that the fund assists employees, and you don't want to keep cases opening forever, and that's why it's necessary that there is a time frame in terms of closing cases, all cases, irrespective of whether it's for people. Because if you get injured and you are disabled at work, how are you going to be treated in this? And then a worker who was disabled when they started work and then they then get a minor injury, their case must be open forever in terms of this process. But the person who gets injured at work and gets disabled in that process, the cases are treated, should be treated. We don't think that is viable, that you should follow that process. Next slide, please. And they go on and they raise the issue of Section 76, on where they amend the substitute subsets of the following subsection, that the technical fees of medical aid and medical association should be paid to organization of disability of disabled people, travel association and association. And we don't think that is we can do this because our law relates to payment that are regulated by the medical service providers and the HPSAA and the health authority in terms of the Health Fund Act. Therefore, we can't make payment outside the legal provisions that they want to work and the qualification. We can't also make payment on health issues on people that we do not know what qualification do they have, whether they are doctors or not doctors in terms of this arena. And as I've said, that we are confined by what the different legislation requires us to do. Next slide, please. Now, solidarity, they oppose the removal of the word accident from the definition of the accidents. And we think this cannot be, it's not an issue at all, because accident, that is accident, means accident. There's no, doesn't make any difference in moving this. We don't understand the issue that they are moving. It's just terminology, tautology that they bring about some clarity. There's no confusion that will be created by the removal of the word accident in this. And Richard Spohr raising the assessment in terms of Schedule 2 should not be restricted to regulation and need to be considered and substituted with a proper consideration in the law. Look, we think that the regulatory framework is necessary, although Schedule 2 fixes the parameters of assessment of disabled. It is not restrictive as such. Therefore, I don't think this is necessary. And because it's not restrictive, and even where restrictive, Section 22.9 mitigate against some of the perceived restriction that Section 42C reads as follows. If any injury or serious mutation contemplated in paragraph A has unusually serious consequences for employees as a result of special nature of the employee's occupation, the Director General may determine such higher percentage as he or deems fit. Therefore, we think that there's enough flexibility in that in this provision for the DG to take a different decision than what the schedule indicates. Next slide, please. And the next issue that they are raising is that the restriction of court order to magistrate court scale must be rejected. This is the law. Oh, the compensation constitution is a crucial statute, and that statute is equivalent to that of the magistrate. The payments that are fixed in terms of the tribunal status, hence the magistrate courts. Now, well, we know that lawyers would want to charge higher fees in terms of these issues, but unfortunately, the tribunal, if the tribunal is at the status of the magistrate court, the fees has got to be linked to that status. Next slide, please. The next comment is from the South African Society of Physiotherapy, where they want the word medical service provider should be replaced by the word healthcare providers. Look, I mean, our view in this is that the healthcare practitioners is defined in the Health Professional Act and the National Health Act, and therefore that's what we're following. If any changes are made in those statutes, then it will follow through into this. we don't think that it's necessary to make those change. And they raise also that because the fund pays, we pay medical aid fees to both practitioners and hospitals, the medical service provider will continue to be used in the bill as a general term in this. And therefore, we really don't think this is necessary. But if, as we said, the Health Practitioner Professional Act is changed, the definitions, they are changed, and the Healthcare Provider and Healthcare Act, the definitions are changed, we can accommodate those. But that's where we're coming from in terms of that. Next slide, please. Next slide, Commissioner, thank you. Now, COSATO made a number of technical amendments that I'm not going to spend a lot of time on because we agree with the changes, some of the most of the changes that they are making. Maybe I'll deal on with the last one where they say complying with the condition determined by the minister. And we want just to make sure that there should be checks and balances that already, there are checks and balances that already exist in the financial service industry in the form of regulation on the issue that they are raising, that the mutual association and those that are working with should be given effect in the right employees and their dependents in order for them to be able to do this. And we think that the checks and balances that exist there are enough in terms of the financial services or organization that deal with that. But all the other issues that they've raised, we are prepared to accept them and incorporate them in the changes because they are just technical changes and technical amendments. Next slide, please. The next issue COSATO is raising that the section 37 should read any license issued any licensee issued with a license in terms of this act shall and then be accountable to the minister and under control of the board and all of the issues. I mean, our view is that the department is of the view that there's much that much is tied to the provision of licensee should be the advice that was given by the prudent authority. The prudent authority has given a proposal that we agree with, that license means a license to ensure a license insurer to whom a license has been issued in terms of Section 30 of this this Act conduct, of the Act to conduct non-life insurance business under Insurance Act. Therefore, if we take that definition and put it there, it will solve all the issues that are raised by COSATO, and it's a definition that is in S2. Next slide, please. The Socioeconomic Rights Institute raised the issues about no transitional provision, and we agree with this to the omission, and will accordingly propose that there should be transitional provision in Section 100. The issues of domestic workers and the transitional provision in terms of they'll have 3 years to launch their old complaint claims that they need to launch. We agree with that, the issue that they are raising on that. And now they are raising the issues of the age limit, that the age limit be limited, should not be limited to 25 years. And we think 25 years is a good enough limit. If you look in the pension fund for public sector, the age limit is 22. And in many other situations, age limit is 21. Now, if the COIDA limit the age limit to 25, it's being very accommodating to children, and we think that it's good enough. It should not be changed to higher than 25 years. Next slide, please. And COMSO, SAMHSA, and others raise, this is the big one, the issue of Section 40, Clause 43, Section 734. The minister spoke about this. The commissioner spoke about this. I mean, what I can say in short, what we agree is that the amendment that we are making, we might be prepared to relook at the amendment. And instead of making the change that we are making, that members agree to make an enabling provision that will allow the minister to regulate the sector in form of registration first, and they will require that every third party that want to intersect with the department, with the commission, should be registered, and that the minister will have an enabling provision that allow him to set up the terms of registration, the conditions of registration in a regulation, and put them on. Then it will take away this issue that is proposed. It will take away Section 73.4 as it is, and instead we'll have an able provision that allow the introduction of regulation to regulate how these organizations operate and make a requirement that they should be registered, that the law be also made an able provision for registration of this organization, and as I've said, enable the minister to publish regulation that will regulate their operation and to deal with all the other problems that we are having in this, to ensure that we are able to give service to the workers that are getting injured at work, but at the same time allow this organization to operate, but under a regime that is regulated through a regulation, then we're not allowing them to transact with the fund. Thank you, Honorable Members.
Thank you, Honorable. Thank you, Mr. Mkhalifi. Thank you very much. And thank you to the Commissioner. Honorable Members, there are the responses. Any clarities?
Thank you, Michael Bagram.
Just to remind members that it's clarities, we're still going to engage on our Honorable Bagram, Honorable Mkhonto, Honorable Dana, in that order. Honorable Bagram.
Thank you, Commissioner. If I may go ahead, I appreciate it, and thank you for the rather lengthy report, and it's something that we're probably not going to tackle in its full, but I'll have a go at some of the queries that I do have. First of all, obviously the issue with regard to the impact assessment, it seems like that many of the stakeholders weren't actually approached in any way. I'm not sure if they're happy with what they got out of this, but it just seems to be rather thin, and maybe they would comment on that. With regard to the legal challenge, now, I don't really understand this, and I presume they're going to give us better input on what the lawyers have to say, but they're trying to justify the changes, the suggested changes, by saying that the POPI Act and personal information, et cetera, et cetera. Now, one would be quite aware that these issues have been to our courts before. In particular against the compensation fund and the minister. The minister's lost numerous cases against
Honorable
third parties.
Honorable
I'm listening.
Questions of clarity.
I'm trying to get the clarity. So what I'm trying to understand the justification for this objection. And maybe they can explain it, because for instance, if I'm a doctor and I want to sue the medical aid, I have to go to my lawyers, and my lawyers will have the invoices and they will then issue the summons. So I'm not sure what the difference is. Maybe they can give us more clarity, but I can go on a little bit on that, but I won't bog it down too much. Just in terms of the transport, they said where the employer provides free transport, that would then be covered. I'm not sure what they mean when the employer maybe justifies giving a loan to buy a car or whatever. What point is it free and what point isn't it free? I don't seem to understand that at all. And I'm not sure why they don't want to cover people going to and from work. I don't understand. It's bad for the workforce. We know that the workforce live far away and they take taxis, and I can't understand the justification. In terms of the issue about barring compensation, and there wouldn't be a limit, a 3-year limit, if they can prove that the employer knew about the accident,
It's very difficult in some cases to show that, and I think they've got to expand a bit on that, because that's going to be very difficult. Many employees do get injured at work. They do go and report it, and the employer never goes forward, and they make no record of it. How does that poor employee, or the union for that matter, how do they prove to the department that the employer knew about it? I don't know what the slide number is, but the comments are with regard to Cresatu, they said they want to change may to must. Once you make that change, it means that the no one can challenge it. In other words, the word may means that it has to be subject to assessment. Must means that the minister's got no choice. And if you don't have any faith in the minister, it looks like Cresatu's got no faith in the minister, then maybe, and I don't understand that, and the department seem to be supporting that proposal. If you have a look at another proposal from Cresatu, and I don't understand the department's comment, it says the insertion of section 37(30) in bracket 7 to read, and then they go on to read about that. The answer from the department is the department is of the view that the much tired provision on the licensees should be the advice. I think they might have made a spelling error over there. If they could have a look at that, I'm not really sure what it means. And again, on the very last proposal from Comsol and Coidlink, etc., they're saying, the department's saying that the commissioner sort of issue rules on the process for payment. Well, there's no control over whatever rules the commissioner issues. And although they're going to put it through publication in the Gazette for comments, I presume that they will let us as a committee comment on that. Thank you, Madam Commissioner. I won't go on. I've got a lot more, but I understand.
Can I humbly request, honourable members, please, straightforward questions of clarity. We're still going to have time to argue for or against. But now, questions of clarity. I'm humbly requesting that. Honourable Mkhonto.
Thanks, Chair. Greetings to you, honourable members, and the minister and the department officials. Chair, I have a request first before I pose my question. Last time I posed some few questions, and there was a question that was nearly omitted. So I will request that whilst responding to my questions, Chair, they must refer to the numbers as I will be referring to them. My first question, Chairperson, I understand what Mr. Mkhalipi has said in the closing statement. And if it wasn't for the overview of the minister, I wouldn't ask this question. Some of those who made submissions proposed that instead of doing away with the refunding, they indicated that they are willing to work within a regulated environment. Why did the department opt to remove them completely instead of putting framework of oversight to ensure that the concerns raised by the fund are addressed? My second question, Chair, is about the issues the department have raised in support of their proposed amendment of Section 73(4) that appears to be mainly on operational nature, which could have been improved through efficiency. Why is the department proposing to address operational issues by legislation and not by operational improvement? Is this admission that the management of the convention have failed to improve operations of the fund, and therefore they are resorting to using parliament to legislate to cover up management competence? Further, Chairperson, why did the department overlook to include this section amendment in the first presentation to this committee and indicate that they didn't see a need for it, only for the committee to be surprised by the overwhelming public responses on this section? The third question, Chair, I think one has to thank the department for listing the third parties. It has opened one's mind. When they were talking about the switching houses, practice managers, agents, pre-funders, there are many flows and links. It looks like the operational issues and the legal framework they presented affect all third parties equally. Yet, Section 73.4 seeks to ban only pre-funders. Is there any particular reason for this, Chairperson? Could be that only pre-funders have a local standard to make management of compensation fund accountable by taking the fund to court to meet its statutory mandate. The fourth question, Chair, we were having the Auditor General last week, and in their presentation, it was obvious that the data from the department system cannot be relied upon, and the Auditor General has issued disclaimers for the last 10 years. The picture painted today seems to be in the realm of compensation management only, but not in the real world. If indeed the processing and payment of claims were that good as they have presented, and they want us to believe, then there will be no third parties in our environment, and the clients of third parties will not just pay away fees if they do not wish. During the oral presentation, it was made clear in the fund, if the fund is efficient, then all your stakeholders will deal directly with the fund, not through intermediary third parties. When will the management of the fund start presenting realistic and reliable data? Because we are being made to consider amendments to legislation without credible data. In the same vein, can the department avail the social impact studies they are referring to? The last one, Chair, that is question number five. I notice there are quite a number of open claims in the department system. If this is compared to the actual number of claims registered per year, there are almost 2 years' volumes of claims that need to be adjudicated. How does this tie in with their claims of 95% of claims being adjudicated within 60 days? Clearly, the oral submissions showed a very different picture. Why do the management of the fund information differ so much with that of the Auditor General and their clients? There is a very obvious contradiction to other numbers reported, which should be relied on. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Dana.
Thank you and good morning, Chair. Good morning to everyone and thank you for the presentation. My questions have partially been covered by the previous two colleagues, so I have just three questions that I want to ask for clarity. The first question is with regards to the personal information that the third parties have access to. Does the POPIA Act not apply to these third parties anyway? So is it not regulated? Is the personal information that these third parties have not regulated anyway by the POPIA Act as well? That's my first question. My second question is on slide 15. Commissioner Mafata indicated that 6,461 employers are registered on the CompEasy system, but the compensation fund has previously stated that they have nearly 450,000 registered employers. So that's about 1.5% registered on the CompEasy system. What is the reason for this anomaly? Because I can't believe that that it's because people's documentation is not in order, etc. So I'd like to know that. And my third question is on the last slide, the rules and regulations proposed by the department or by the compensation fund that would regulate the use of third parties. I'd like to know an example, or maybe we can get an idea of these rules that would be set by the department, and will this form part of this amendment, because I think it's important for us to consider that as well. Thank you, Chair. That's all I have for now.
Thank you, Honourable Mugabe.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, and good morning to all the members. The clarity I'm seeking, Chair, the comments on proposed amendments slides are not numbered, so I would just make the comment on the basis of what I've written. Can then the department clarify the constitutionality of unequal benefits for workers in similar situation will have to ascertain, have there been any other claims or litigations that have been raised or issued against the department in relation to this unconstitutionality of unequal benefits? The second one, Chair, is on the Compensation Fund Act of 1941. Understanding that the Act was enacted on a different environment. Therefore, my question would be, has the department not looked into why not review or rewrite the Act under the different environment altogether as compared to the time that it was enacted as the principal Act? Fourth one, Chair, it's the agreed penalty with the social partners at NEDLAC of 10% of the total annual earnings of employees. My question is, on what the department's response is that of the total employees, which therefore then just stop at that. It does not then clarify whether the 10% is for the total employees that were involved in the accident, or is the total workforce of that particular company, if they can clarify that part for me. The last one, Chair, is on the last slide. If the department can clarify the difference in terms of the rules that would then be gazetted in relation to the confidentiality of the information of a patient, how would that reconcile, if ever there are those that would then be regulated and those that would not be allowed at all in the system? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Gary, Honourable Kado.
Thank you, Chair. I've got two questions. Firstly, as far as I can tell, the South African Medical Fraternity and third-party administrators weren't consulted in the social and economic impact assessment exercise about the bill. And I would like you to clarify, if indeed this is the case, why is it so, given that the bill in its current form would completely change the way that third-party administrators interact with the compensation fund? And then secondly, this portfolio committee heard from the Auditor General's office on Friday. They appeared before our committee, and they gave a harrowing report on just how dysfunctional the fund is and why it received an audit disclaimer and why it's been receiving audit disclaimers repeatedly. And the bottom line is that the compensation fund is woefully poorly administered. And the switch over to the CompEasy system, which we heard a great deal of during the course of this morning's presentation, has been an unmitigated disaster. And we also heard from many of the submissioners on the bill during the public hearings, particularly around Section 43, that the bill in its current form would make the situation worse. So I'd like the department to clarify in just one or two sentences how this bill is going to help. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I missed your first question, Honourable Kado. I don't know whether it's my system.
I'll repeat it for your benefit, Chair. My first question was around the social economic impact assessment exercise and why the medical fraternity and third-party administrators weren't consulted when this bill is going to have such a massive impact on the way they interact with the compensation fund. That's it.
Oh, thank you. Mr. Mkalipi, Mr. Mafata. DG, any from the department? Mr. Mkalipi?
I think the first thing that we need to explain, and some of these questions will fall away on the basis of this. The last slide, we indicate, if the committee and the members accept the proposal that we are making in the last slide that says an enabling provision must be made to allow the introduction of regulation and also to allow the registration of all third parties that interact with the fund, that intersect with the fund. Then the proposed section 73.4 as it stands in the bill will fall away. That's the first thing that we need to understand, the implication of that proposal, is that instead of, as the word that was used, banning any third party, the proposal of the slide is that then an enabling provision be created in the law that will allow first two things. One, the registration of all the organizations that want to interact with the fund as third parties. That's the first thing. They need to register with the fund. Secondly, that then the minister must be able by regulation to publish the condition of registration and what will be needed for them to register with the fund. Obviously, if members of parliament want to have the sight of those regulations, they can have the sight of regulation. But that's what the intent of the last slide that is being proposed, that instead of them banning, I don't want to use the word banning anybody on any third party, you will allow all of them to operate as long as they operate within the parameters that will be published. As members would know, all regulations that are published are published for public comment. Nothing prevents the members of parliament saying that they want to have sight of the regulation that will be put on the table and so that they can see what within the regulation. It's going to be very difficult sitting here to say, well, this is what the regulation will say. We can't give those answers and say this is what the regulation will say. The regulation will be published, and I say as members, if the members want to see sight of that regulation, then they can make that request and make that decision, and they have sight of it, of the regulation. But most of the questions that are asked on the basis of the current position of the bill, disregarding what we're saying in the last slide of in terms of Section 73, for what we say enabling provision. That's the first issue that I wanted just to explain, so that some of the questions that you're asking that are about third party interaction are dealt with it here. We're dealing with them on those bases. Now, on the issue raised by Honorable Bagrin on the issue of saying that the fund must pay all transport. Now, the issue raised by the Mineral Council here is that we must amend the section dealing with transport and have the words that they are raising, that the fund must pay for any transport arranged by the employer. The current legislation says that we pay for an injury that has occurred in a transport that is involved in furtherance of the business of the employer. Now, we make the example that we're making about people traveling. It's not what the law talks about. We're making an example. If you say the terminology there should read arranged instead of furtherance of the business of the employer, is that you've got the unintended consequences of the fund having a liability on any accident that has taken place that has been arranged by the employer. And we're making an example of somebody who the employer has arranged the transport to go home for whatever reason, or to go wherever they want to go. In that transport, they are not furthering the business of the employer. And that's the issue that you, and then we don't think that it would be viable for the fund to be paying for any transport. And we're making an example of people who are using their own transport through the arrangement of the employer, like a car allowance, a car subsidy that they use, they drive themselves. And we agree that in a transport, and we made an example of the construction industry, where the company pick up employees, put them in the truck, whether it is safe or not safe, we don't want to talk about that at this stage, put them in the truck and they are involved in an accident. Now, whether they are going home or they are going to the construction site, if they get an accident, they are regarded as being covered by the law as it is. And that's the example that we are making. And we say the same apply in the farming sector, where a farmer goes up, pick up workers at a spot, and then take them to the farm. On the way to the farm, they are involved with an accident. They will be covered by the law. But the notion that the fund must cover every transport that an employee is traveling in to work, whether that is controlled by the employer or not controlled by the employer, we don't think that notion is viable for the fund. Although we're not saying that the employer should not be responsible for payment in the transport that the fund has provided. The issue of regulation that is raised by Honorable Mkonto, that they are raising that the regulation, how will the regulation work? As I've said, I've answered this issue. At this stage, we are not going to be able to say this is how the regulation will be, this is how it will read, until we have this enabling provision that allows that, and the members could ask the regulation to be presented. They could have a sight of the regulation. On the issue of the socio-economic impact assessment, that was provided to the members after the first presentation that we had here. A copy was given to the secretary. The secretary, we understand, that has given to all the members of the committee. Whether the socio-economic impact assessment is covering all the areas that the members would want to cover, and that's why we are explaining how the socio-economic impact assessment works. The Department of Monitoring and Evaluation give all departments the same template in terms of what are the issues that need to be in the socio-economic impact assessment. And we input the information and provide it to them, and they pass the social impact study, or they fail it. But it's not, we don't decide whether is it proper or not proper. We provide the information, we give it to them, they issue the certificate. If they are not happy with what we've written, they will not issue the certificate, therefore we will not be able to move forward in terms of this. It's not something that is controlled by us, but it is available. It was sent to the secretary's office, and we know that they sent it to all the members of this committee in terms of that. Now, on the issue of whether the members who are affected, who commented here, were consulted. In the consultation process, NEDLAC represent all business. All business are represented by BUSA or Black Management Forum, the Business Forum at NEDLAC, on behalf of business. But that consultation took place. In the public hearing, we call everybody concerned to come in and make their input. We don't call in specific individuals. Parties, we call everybody that is will be affected by the legislation. Now, if parties choose not to attend the public processes that are arranged, what must we do as government or as departments when parties don't attend the public comments and they don't attend the consultation. And even different consultation, if they want further meetings with the fund, I'm sure those meetings could have been arranged if they were asked after the public hearing for them to be able to deal with the issues that they want to deal with. The issue about why don't we do just a press legislation and cancel everything? Well, you've got two options in terms of legislation. You could delete, basically, do away with the old legislation, or you can amend. We've opted for the amendment of the legislation, and we're making the changes and this on this legislation as part of that process so that it can be can meet the test of time, the times that we're living in now. Now, on the issues of constitutionality of unequal benefit, I mean, the case that is known by everybody, the issue of domestic workers, the issue of equality in terms of that was taken to court where we were found that the exclusion of domestic workers in COIDA is unconstitutional. Now, there's not been a case of constitutionality between Odimwa and COIDA that are offering for similar accidents, similar situation, different benefits. The COIDA are offering different benefits in a certain areas far better than Odimwa, Odimwa better in certain areas than the COIDA. And that's what the discussion that must take place between Department of Health and the other parties in the amalgamation of these processes. Now, on the issue of the 10% is not the 10% of the wage of the employee that has been injured, that is in the bill. The bill talk about the 10% of the overall, basically, declaration that has been made by the employer. Remember, the employer on an annual basis declared to the fund that I employ, this is my the total amount of money that I pay on my employees, all my employees. I have got 1,000 employees and I pay R1 million for them, all of them. And that will be that 10%, not the 10% of the employees that have been injured. That's why when I was raising this issue, explaining it that we believe that the penalty should be reasonable enough to make employers do the right thing, and it should not be high so that it affects the profitability of employers. And I'm sure the commissioner can add.
Mr. Mafata?
Thank you, Chair. Just one or two things, Chair. Mr. Mkalipi has covered the majority of the issues. I think maybe going back to the issue of transportation of workers. So we know that in South Africa, we have many social security instruments. The COID legislation is just one of them. And COID does not cover all instances of income relief as a form of social security. So where a person gets involved in a motor vehicle accident, if it was not in furtherance of the employer's business, it does not necessarily mean that that person doesn't have social protection cover, because we have the Road Accident Fund, which has been established to be able to cover such incidents. So people are not left without any social security whatsoever. I just thought I should just emphasize that. So the issue that was raised by Honorable Mkonto on the operational issue. So the point we're trying to display here is that we have a legal problem, which if it's not addressed, it has unintended consequences operationally, right? The legislation by itself is meant, the primary beneficiary of the COID legislation is meant to be the injured worker. Yet with the way things are working, the injured worker doesn't seem to be the primary beneficiary, because the primary beneficiary has become somebody else, and they are just an afterthought in the value chain. And that's the issue that these amendments are seeking to correct. I think the other issues Mr. Kaipi has spoken about, maybe just the last issue on the constitutionality. and the COIT, the Compensation Act of 1941. In 1993, when the current COIT legislation was enacted, so there was a modernization process to try and bring in the COIT legislation in line with the ILO standards, as well as making sure that all other excluded forms of workers are incorporated in the COIT legislation. That's when we moved from the Workmen's Compensation Act to the Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Diseases Act. There is indeed scope for further improvements as well as things evolve in the labor market, and I'm sure that's something that the department will continuously look at. The issue of constitutionality. So the input that was made by the Mineral Council was that novice workers, which are those workers who are entering the mining sector for the first time, such workers should not be covered under Podimo, but such workers should enjoy their cover under the COIDA legislation. So the issue of constitutionality that we're bringing to the fore is that you would have workers working in the same sector who, when they get injured or suffer an occupational, similar occupational disease, they would then be subject to different type of benefits, because the benefits that a non-novice worker would get under OJIMA would be different to the benefits that a novice worker would get under COIDA for the same injury. So I think the other issues, Chair, Mr. Mkalipi has responded to. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Mafata, Commissioner Mafata, and Mr. Mkalipi. We will, as we have said initially, that this process is a process that is going to, as we move forward, we are still going to interact now as the committee. We will indicate the dates, because remember that we are rising on Friday, and we will then be back in August, and therefore we will then have to apply to have these sittings. Because it's the time that will be on of constituency period, but we can't just wait and not do the work. In fact, that it is the work of the bill. We're dealing with the legislation, so we'll have to juggle in between. We will make that application, and we will then communicate with the members. I think we have been responded to. I think the small error that. Which it's small, but it's very important that DG documents are to be numbered. So that was one member, I think it was Honorable Mugabe, said he's going to speak on a document that unfortunately is not numbered. My apologies, Honorable members, for that, because we should have indicated to the department that they must number those documents. I don't know whether DG, is there anything you would like to maybe to clarify further in terms of the responses that have been given? Is the teacher still with us?
Yes, Chair. I'm still with you, Chair. Yes.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Just 2 points, Chair. Both Mr. Mkalipi and Mr. Mafata touched on these 2 things. So one was on the the issue of the issue raised by mineral councils with regards to the novice mine workers. I just want to give a context to this. There was a cabinet decision that was taken years ago. If I remember well, it was in 1999, where there was a decision that we need to integrate the occupational health and safety competences and the compensation fund competences. So we were mandated to start the process, which we duly started, and there was a proposed bill which was supposed to provide a framework for the integration of these competences that I've mentioned. However, the process was stopped in 2009, and over the years it has been resuscitated and stopped for a number of reasons. So that's the only way that we think that we could address the issue of making sure that all the workers in all the sectors, they get compensated the same amount of money, and that you have one compensation fund that takes care of all the workers in all the different sectors, although you still have the mutuals to cater for different sectors if they have been licensed to do so. So there's that pending exercise that has not been finalized yet. I was just raising it to bring context to this, because if you bring it now and you put it in the compensation fund and you have not addressed the other issues that that are creating quite a lot of challenges, not only in the compensation fund but in the ODIMWA as well, you're not addressing the problem. You're just peppering over the cracks. The second point I want to raise, Chair, is a question raised by Honorable Kado with regards to the comments made by AG. And I think the AG in their report, they made it clear that their audit findings were related to 2019 financial year. And they were in no way a reflection of the operation of the new system, computer. So everything that is in that audit finding has to do with Umehluko, the inefficiencies that were Umehluko, the control deficiencies that were on Umehluko, not the COMEASY. COMEASY is a different system, and AG has not yet expressed an opinion in terms of the adequacy of the controls developed, that have been put in the system. So this bill, will it improve the administration of the fund? Certainly it will, especially if the issues that were raised by Commissioner Mafata are addressed. If they are addressed, it will help us in making sure that we have a compensation fund that works according to the rules and rules that are applicable, not only in the compensation fund, but rules that are applied by all medical aids. And we're just finding it very strange that when we apply the rules as government, the rules are frowned upon, and yet when it's the private sector, everybody abides by the rules. So it's because you can't just allow anybody to transact on your system without putting those proper rules. But most certainly for us, it will help us to make sure that whoever submits a claim, that claim, if we've accepted liability, the claim will be processed. If no liability has been accepted, the claim will not be processed, and we will not pay invoices that are not as a result of the claim that has been accepted by the funds. So these are the challenges that we had with the previous system, as mentioned by the commissioner, that service providers will just submit these things because there were no proper controls in the system. And now that we're putting these controls, it seems to me that everybody is crying foul that they will not have a free access to the system as they had. We just want to say we want to work with everybody, but we must work within the rules that are applicable, not only by applicable or to the fund, but to the sectors that are in the space that we operate in as a compensation fund. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Gigi. There are two guests that they didn't introduce themselves. I only see them now. It's Ms. Angie Richardson. From which institution you are coming from, ma'am, or company?
Madam Chair, I'm from IWAG. We presented earlier with the public submissions.
And Mr. Brian Pivo?
I'm WCA Workers' Compensation Assistance, Madam Chair.
Workers' Compensation Assistance, oh, okay. No, thank you very much. I don't know whether the Minister is back. I see DM, any closing remarks?
I'm there, Chair.
Minister, yes, thank you.
I was going to say the Minister will do that.
Oh, I didn't see him. Okay. All right, Minister.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. And thanks for the inputs. But I thought that, Chairperson, I must just respond to two issues. The first one, in fact, it's mainly from Honorable Cardo, that the medical aid or the relevant sector, they were not consulted on this matter. And I think Mr. Mkalipe put it very well, that we consulted at the level of NEDLAC. And what normally happens on this consultation at NEDLAC, which remains a very important forum, whenever there are issues affecting a particular sector, the party or parties to NEDLAC would constitute their delegation in such a way that they ensure that relevant people from the affected sector are part of those discussions. We've been discussing a number of sectoral issues, and the social partners would bring the relevant people. If they do not bring the relevant people, it's up to them. But NEDLAC is there for all these consultations, and we think that is the most inclusive. That's the first one. And we hope that people at NEDLAC, who are, they are not representing their targets, they are representing constituencies who are affected by the issues. The second issue, Chairperson, that the fund is poorly administered, and the bill in its current form will make the situation worse. Chairperson, I think we have acknowledged all the weaknesses of the fund. We have acknowledged that. And we are dealing with all those issues in terms of the programs which we have put in place. And I thought that the relevant question should be, maybe from Honorable Cardo, what are you doing with those weaknesses identified weaknesses which have been identified, how are you dealing with them in a systemic way so that they cannot be able to disturb the implementation of this particular bill? But we must also understand that part of these systemic issues, we're trying to address them through these amendments. Unless you have these amendments, you are not going to be able to address the fundamental issues or some of the fundamental issues in the fund. So we're doing both by also looking into those systemic issues. We are trying to address those fundamental weaknesses which you're talking about. The third issue, Chairperson, as the bill stands, or we have made those proposals in relation to the role of the third parties who are acting on behalf of the service providers. And we want to think, the members to think about the experiences of the Road Accident Fund as to who was benefiting in the Road Accident Fund more than the victims themselves. We have to think about that. And we have listed the legal problems also. Why we've gone this particular, or we have this particular proposal. But if there's this proposal, which I think Mr. Mkhalipi ended up with, for the regulations, we're not just going to close our ears. We must listen to the logic and evaluate it and see if it will cover us in terms of the concerns which are being raised. So if the regulations will be an easy route but will cover the issues we are dealing with, I don't think we'll close. But let the debate continue. Well, I've said the other day, this is my last point, Chairperson. I've said the other day, we are here presenting our logic. We are open to other points which are differing with us, but at the end, the powerful reason should rule. But there will come a time where we don't agree, and somebody must take a decision. But we are here open to persuasion, to discussion, and so on. At the end of the day, at the center of it, it must be that injured worker, more than all the other interests. That's how I close it. Chairperson and honorable members. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. I don't know what has happened to my other gadget. I hope it's not messing up the process. I'm trying to open the screen. We, honorable members, I think now we have come to the end of our processes in terms of preparing for our deliberations. We will then come back and we'll interact with members. When are we then going to start deliberations? But we are still going to apply for another special sitting, which will be during constituency, to call the department minister and the both affected departments in terms of the AG's report for us to ask some of the difficult questions which we think are to be asked. So members must understand that we are then going to have that work, but it will be work that will allow us to do our constituency work. My humble plea and my solemn prayer is that we do that now that we are starting, so that by the end of by the beginning of July and August, we are to be focusing onto our constituency work. And the last is that I hope members have documented all what has been said, the responses, and please try and sort out your documents in terms of the brief. We still have a separate week for employment equity, and we'll also again have a separate week for CODA in terms of deliberations. And thank you very much. Thank everybody that is here and our guests that has shown interest in our work. We appreciate that. And thank the minister and his deputy for really ensuring that they respect the committee and they always come in front of the committee. That is a sign that the executive is not taking Parliament and in terms of the committee for granted. And I think we appreciate that. It's not easy, but I think it's important that we do appreciate your coming in front of the committee. That means a lot in particular to us as members of Parliament. Honourable members, until we meet again, which will be informed through a correspondence by the relevant office in terms of the support staff, our meeting stand adjourned. Plenary today, which is vote one, is starting at 2:00. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much to everyone.
Okay.